from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, it's Dave Graham, Dave Graham Show, WDEV, FM, and AM. We are broadcasting live this morning. I also have an opportunity to meet some of the leaders in Vermont agriculture, and we want to mention that a little later in the show we're going to be talking to leaders of the Christmas Tree Growers Association today, the Beekeepers Association. We're going to have some folks in tomorrow from Vermont, the Vermont Farm to Table program. But I wanted to start out actually with an overview of the whole sort of situation, the situational report or whatever on Vermont agriculture, and who better to deliver that with us but a former WDEV employee and much loved announcer and bird watcher on WDEV. Anson Tebbets joins me as my first guest this morning. Anson, thanks so much for stopping by.
Well, good morning, Dave, and it's great to be here. I think I've been to this show a number of years. I can't remember how many years I've been coming to this, even back when it was at the Barry Auditorium over the years. So it's great to have this tradition continue, and I guess it's officially the first fair of the season, believe it or not.
The first fair of the season. There you go. That's that had not occurred to me, but the first fair of the year probably in Vermont for sure.
Yeah.
So, lots going on in Vermont agriculture these days. Some things continue in the sort of traditional pattern, and other things are new and exciting and changing. And so let's dig right in here for a few minutes and just ask you, obviously we know that the real dominant part of agriculture in Vermont remains our dairy industry. And I'm hearing some signs of good news, or at least hope, in the dairy industry. Milk prices might be ticking up a bit, and there just seems to be some optimism out there, maybe more than was evident at last year's farm show. So tell me what's going on there.
I think you're right on that. Compared to last year at this time, there was not a lot of great news happening in the dairy world. We have about 700 dairy farmers in Vermont. It's about a $2 billion industry, very, very important for our rural economy. And the federal system is headed in the right direction. We've had a system over the last 5 years where it's been a really challenging, difficult time for our dairy farmers. But over the last couple of months, 3 or 4 months, there's been an indication the price is headed in the right direction. Granted, a lot of people were hurt along the way, and that's really disappointing. But right now, I think there's a little bit of enthusiasm where the price of milk being paid to farmers is headed in the right direction, and it's stabilized a little bit, so maybe people can recover.
And there is a fair amount to recover from, because it was really quite a dip in the last few years, from what I understand.
Absolutely. It was well under the cost of production for most of our dairy farmers. We did lose some dairy farmers because they just couldn't sustain that economic system. And they're kind of at the whims of a federal system and an international system. And what led to the decline was there was too much milk in the United States, and it didn't have a place to go. So the markets weren't there. We had some disruption with trade around the world, and that didn't help things. Those things seem to have settled down. One of the astonishing figures is about 15% of all dairy in the United States is exported now. So it's quite a system where you rely, and 1%, 2% here can really make a tremendous difference in what the farmers paid for. But that appears to settle down. Hopefully some of those markets will come back that were lost during some of these trade disputes, and things will get on the right path for our dairy farmers and all those in working in agriculture.
Meanwhile, there's just tons of new stuff that keeps popping up on the agricultural scene in Vermont. I mean, we've had a lot of coverage on our show, and as well as in the media in general in Vermont the last couple of years, about the burgeoning hemp industry, but many other sort of facets. And one of the things I think we're going to be talking about over the course of these 3 days here at the Farm Show is indoor agriculture. That's something that's just completely new to me. It just was mentioned to me yesterday, and I think we're going to bring in a guest or two tomorrow to talk to us about that. What is going on the indoor agriculture front?
Yeah, we have some, and particularly on the greens front. So if people are making, basil or tomatoes or microgreens, there are some operations particularly in the Mad River Valley. There's one where they have a tremendous market for growing basil, and they grow it inside, and then they are in some of the bigger markets where they're selling to Whole Foods and so forth. There's a burgeoning company coming out of Barrie also that's growing some products inside under lights, under controlled conditions. So there are people doing that, and you know, you talk with some of the people who buy these products, particularly if you talk with some of our co-ops, some of our small retailers, grocery stores, they say the consumers really like them. The product is predictable, it's often very clean, they see a market for it. And so there are some operations throughout the state. Of course, there's also a number of people that are growing vegetables the traditional way, outside and in the spring and the summer.
And the I mentioned hemp just because that seems to be just a source of a lot of excitement and investment on the part of Vermont farmers these days, and a younger generation, it seems, coming in too. What do you make of the future of the hemp industry in Vermont?
Well, we had an exciting year last year, and part of it was because the federal government legalized hemp. So it became legalized. Congress and the president signed it in. It took it off of the Controlled Substance Act. So there was a tremendous enthusiasm out there. We had probably close to 950 to 1,000 growers in Vermont last year. Some tried it for the first time. We had some people that have been in this space maybe 3 or 4 years. And people are growing it anywhere from, maybe an acre to 5 acres. They have to register with the Agency of Agriculture, and so, identify where they're growing it. I think there's potential for that market to continue to grow. Most of it is being, pressed into oil for CBD and products. Some of the other markets, I think, will develop because it's such a durable plant. But we have some major companies in Vermont that are working in hemp, and I think there's opportunity with some solid business planning and some solid knowledge and need and technical assistance. I think there's an opportunity for that market to grow as well.
And just while we're on sort of this leading edge of entrepreneurialism or whatever, where that meets agriculture, I had a gentleman, Brian Levin from Stowe, on the show a couple months ago. He's growing saffron.
Oh yes, that was UVM has done a lot of research on that, and that's a spice that most of it is imported from other parts of the world. But that's another diversification. Doesn't take a lot of land. Doesn't take you to grow it inside and so forth. But UVM has done a lot of work on that. That's one of those, crops. What we're trying to do is we're trying to give farmers options and alternatives and choices and maybe get them the proper information that they need, because Vermonters are pretty good at growing things and knowing how to develop a quality product. We just have to give them all the support we can to get them the technical assistance and in some cases the financial assistance that they need to take it to the next level.
And then, of course, in some of our more traditional crops, so let's talk about maple for a moment, because even in that there are some big changes going on.
Maple continues to grow, and the maple folks are saying anywhere from 8 to 10% a year it continues to grow. Right now the trend is you're finding maple in other things outside of just your morning pancakes or your waffles. It's being infused in all sorts of ingredients, and it's a natural sweetener. Consumers now are really focused on what's in something that they're eating, and there is a trend out there for something that's natural, and there's nothing that's more natural than boiling sap and turning it into maple syrup. So that continues to grow, and there's a huge number of people are still growing their operations and tapping more trees than ever, but it's growing at a clip of anywhere from 8 to 10% a year.
We have some it used to be maple was considered to be one of these real small-scale, homegrown kind of approaches. These days it's getting bigger and more mechanized, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the thing about maple. They're always innovating, changing, looking at technology, everything from the spout to the how you boil the sap and the reverse osmosis and the technology. We have some major producers in Vermont that do thousands of taps, but we still have a number of traditional sugar makers that may be on a scale of 1,000 taps to 5,000 taps to 10,000 taps, but the technology has come right along with it, and they're able to get more syrup out of that sap than they ever had because of the innovation of the maple industry, and it's always changing, whether it's new tubing or new ways to boil the sap or new ways to gather it or et cetera. So there's always something happening in the maple industry, but it is truly one of our big industries. Vermont continues to lead the nation in maple production. About half the crop in the United States comes out of the Green Mountains. So we're a major force with that, and we hope to continue to support that industry in any way we can.
Food-grade grains is also on a list I'm looking at of product briefs in a new booklet that just came out. This is the a sort of general overview of Vermont agriculture that was produced by your agency, the Vermont Agriculture and Food System Plan 2020. This is just part one, and came out January 15th. It's well worth a look. It's the Vermont Department or Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, and the Farm to Plate Network are the folks responsible for this report. And I'm just going down a list of sort of chapter headings here. Food grade grains. I've always sort of been under the impression that it's tough to grow some of the food grade grains in Vermont. What are we finding these days?
Yeah, and that's something to look at as we diversify. There are some people that are working on, as you know, we have a incredible folks that make bread in Vermont. You can go just about every community in Vermont and find incredible breads. And they're always looking for grains that can make bread and baked goods. Mm-hmm. So there are a few folks out there working on it, but they need the technical assistance, they need the help, and this report you're referring to basically looks at all the different commodities. It's the first half of a plan. We're going from apples to maple. There's an extensive part about what we're going to do with dairy and grass-fed beef and honey and maple and all those. And this is a detailed report that talked to all of those people that are working in their fields. And it looked at the lay of the land, what's happening now, where the gaps and where the needs are, and where the opportunities are, and also looked at some recommendations in this extensive report. It's about 100 pages long, and it looks at all different aspects of agriculture. And over the next 3 or 4 years, 5 years, we're going to try to make some progress on some of these points in this report.
Yeah, you mentioned the breads. I gotta say, we are spoiled around here.
Oh, it's unbelievable. We have, we are Vermont, and just incredible. We are so fortunate to have such quality food, and that's part of our mission. What we have to focus on in anything we do, and that's quality over quantity, and get it to those bigger markets where they can return a better price. And that's what we have to do, regardless if it's maple or grain or hemp or milk or dairy. That's what we have to do.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I have family and friends who come to visit from other parts of the country, and we'll go to one of the co-ops, usually the Hunger Mountain, because I live in Montpelier, and they look at the breads there, available from La Panchada and Mangies and Red Hen and so on, and they're awestruck. They I have a brother who lives in San Diego, and huge city. And it's hard to find a range of breads as good.
No, he's probably getting the sliced white stuff out of the plastic bag in San Diego,
So there you go. Anyway, among the other, this is just a fun thing to kind of take the survey here with the Secretary of Agriculture, Anson Tebbets. And Anson is a longtime dairy farmer in Cabot himself, I seem to recall.
Up on the hill there. And I got to say, this is pretty good farm show weather. We should be, you know, normally we have ice or snow or 20 below or a big fire drill or something like that. But something about this is just the roads are all clear. It's like 30 degrees outside, and it's not really January, I don't think, in Vermont.
Well, it must be climate change. Speaking of which, we're actually there's going to be a focus group, I think, of farmers talking about climate change.
Yeah, it's a big part of what they're dealing with now, from sugar makers to those that are planting crops. Last year we had about 15 inches more rain than we normally have, and you can well imagine that just is really hard to manage on the farm. So, yeah they're looking at all kinds of things. We've got a group that worked over the summer working on payment for ecosystems, and they're looking at an environmental program that protects soils and the gold standard for environmental protection. And I think climate change will be a factor and a positive thing that farmers can help with this, because they can sequester some carbon with taking care of the land. So that will be a discussion I think they're all focused on. But yeah, anyone that's working out in the woods or in the on the land over the last couple of years have been really challenged with some incredible weather and some weather events. You know, the Halloween storm that we had really impacted particularly Franklin and Orleans County. They had one farmer said that they in 30 years never seen rain in 24 hours like they had in that particular period. So it's something that they're dealing with every day.
That presents some tough challenges. I wanted to ask about any specific legislation that the agency is involved with this year to deal with those or other issues. What's going on?
We're into the fourth week of the legislature, and we were at the House Appropriations Committee yesterday. One thing that the governor and the agency are pushing for is more investment in the Working Lands program. This is a program where it's a granting program where we're offering assistance to those working in the value-added production of agriculture, both in the forestry and also on the farm side. And the governor's put an extra $750,000 into that program. We're hoping the legislature will endorse that and get that through, because we have a tremendous need out there of folks that are looking to grow their businesses. This can help with infrastructure. For example, we have a company that started in Plainfield that was making sliced meats and so forth, and they needed some equipment or some help with the business planning. This particular program helped them get it to the next scale. Now Vermont Salume is in downtown Barrie now. Mm-hmm. They're in the old Homer Fitz building. They've got a processing facility there. And their plan is to open up a retail operation in the front part of that store in downtown Barrie. So that's an example where it gets to a small company, a food company, to the next level, and it plays an important part. So we're hoping to get more dollars for that and get some more money out on the land, because one of our focuses this year is working on rural Vermont. As we know, is struggling in many aspects because of population decline and how to get more people to live and work in rural America and in rural Vermont and rural New England and all around. And this program can help do that. So we hope we can get some extra dollars to get more money out on the landscape to grow some of those businesses and get more workers and more families living in rural Vermont.
Yeah, that is a tough challenge. Many of our rural communities are shrinking, frankly, and population shifting to more populous areas of the state. No magic bullet, though, right?
No, it's no magic bullet, and we just got to continue to, offer choices, help, anything we can do to, get more infrastructure to get them to the next level, make it more affordable for them to do businesses. But this is an important program that has been successful over the years, and we just think we need to put more investment in it. It will help some of those small food companies and forestry businesses as well, value added.
All right. Well, Anson Tebbets, the Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. I want to thank you so much for stopping by this morning.
Thank you, Dave, and have a great show. You're going to meet a lot of great people here and a lot of great work going on here, and Jackie and the whole crew, but thank you so much.
All righty. We're going to take a brief break here for some bottom-of-the-hour CBS News, a couple of words from our sponsors, and don't forget about our podcast, folks, WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll find our podcasts also available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and other places as well. So stay with us. We'll be back with more from the Farm Show, the Lawn Farm Show at the Champlain Valley Expo in just a couple of minutes.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Our show continues here from the Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction, Vermont, where we are attending the first of 3 days, and we'll be here all 3 days, of the Vermont Farm Show for 2020. And it is it's a filling up place. It's getting a little more crowded, and folks are checking out a whole lot of different exhibits on all many, many different kinds of agriculture just within where I can sit here at our broadcast booth with our main entrance of the Miller Pavilion. I can see the homespun yarding competitions, the field and forage crops display, University of Vermont Extension, and so it's quite a range of stuff here. I'm going to get a little walking around in after the show and take in some of the other exhibits here as well. It's quite an extensive show here. A lot of really fun to look at farm equipment, too. Probably not fun to pay for. You got to take out a mortgage on some of these giant machines these guys are using. But next on the program here, I wanted to talk about what I think is a kind of a fascinating segment of Vermont agriculture, and that is our Christmas tree industry. And joining me, we have Bob White. He's with the Vermont Christmas Tree Growers Association. He is a grower himself based in Essex, and he has a lot of experience in this. I guess he's been growing Christmas trees in Vermont since 1990, so it's getting up to 30 years these days. Bob White, thank you very much for sitting down and joining me on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV.
Thanks for the invitation.
And I wanted to check in with you and just find out a little bit about the Christmas tree industry in Vermont. Is it a growing thing? Is it shrinking? Is it sort of staying pretty much status quo, or what's the trend?
It's pretty much a status quo because we're mostly all smaller farms, and you always have guys retiring because you get to be my age, and then you have some young folks come in, and so it balances out.
And tell me a little bit about if somebody is a young person coming in particular, thinking about getting into the Christmas tree business. How many years does it sort of take to get a crop in the ground and then get a harvestable supply of good Christmas trees?
That's a difficulty. It's anybody that wants to start, unless they have another income source, there's no way it's going to work for them, because it's about an 8 to 10 year process before you get everything ready to go to sell.
So 8 to 10 years of just working hard and making investments and not getting any return, and then the return comes later.
Exactly. If everything goes right.
That is that's the issue with a lot of tree crops and tree farming of different types. It takes a while, but I suspect that once the income starts flowing, it makes the picture a little better.
it actually does, because it's Christmas trees, like any other wood product, is capital gains, so it gets better tax treatment. But all the time you're growing it and all the investment you make, you might have taken a trip around the world, because it's almost like a vacation. You aren't getting any tax write-off or anything.
Yeah, wow, that's... So those initial years of when you're actually making the investment, that's the case. You don't get tax write-offs.
You don't get anything.
Wow. So that does there sounds like there's some barriers there. What do you recommend in terms of if somebody wants to, start a, what's a typical acreage for stuff?
typically, if somebody has a backyard, it would not work well. Mm-hmm. Five to 20 acres would be really nice.
Okay. So if somebody has, say, a 10-acre lot and they're saying, I'm going to grow Christmas trees here, what kind of upfront investment are we talking about?
It's not, if they already own the land, it's not substantial because they can do it just with hard elbow grease.
Yep.
And without much equipment and make it all work.
Wow. Okay. So in terms of the hours you're putting in, is it a full-time job or is it something you do on weekends or how does that work?
For our side, it's certainly full-time. We're a large sugaring operation in the winter and then we're Christmas trees all the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the real key thing you got to know to start into it is, do you have the good soils to do it? If you don't have the right soils, don't start. Most people fail from that because they don't understand wet ground doesn't work for Christmas trees.
Hmm.
And the other thing is, there's like New Hampshire Vermont Association that we belong to. Join the association and learn some things. Go to a few farms. And you get rid of all the stupid things that many of the rest of us have learned the hard way. People are happy to tell you that, so you can learn how to do it yourself without making those mistakes yourself.
What kind of soils do you want?
Not sand soil, mm-hmm. but a nice loam, a river bottom loam works really good until you get a flood like at my place.
Oh.
gravelly soil works great.
Huh.
Clay is not going to work.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of trees are you growing? What are the species of evergreens?
In this area, primarily it's balsam and Fraser.
Okay.
There are a few others, but the primary ones are the balsam and Fraser, a few crosses in between, and some exotic trees, but those are the primary.
Okay. And the what are some of the challenges in terms of, I don't know, are there any pests or blights you got to worry about and that kind of thing?
There's everything. it just, if you have a garden, mm-hmm. You get pests in your garden. They might eat your tomatoes, they might eat your potatoes, whatever. You kind of work with that. But there's we hear that all the time, but is there any bugs in a Christmas tree? Well, is there any bugs in your garden this time of year? No, because they either die or they go underground. And the same thing with Christmas trees is we're kind of like them there. The birds like them. Everybody, it's a good balanced ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And then once wintertime hits, they go away. We sell the trees, they go to your house, and it works really good.
How many Christmas trees do you typically sell in a good year?
If we're lucky, between 5,000 and 7,000, something like that at our farm.
Okay. So this is actually a full-time business for you?
Oh, yeah. We have probably at selling season, we have up to like 30 employees.
Wow. That is quite an operation.
Yeah.
So, do you do a lot of sort of cut your own kind of thing? And are you you ship them, and how far do you ship them?
We're all cut your own until we run out of trees because it takes 8 or 10 years to grow them and they go away in a couple of weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So after a couple of years of that, and everybody, their aunts and uncles tell their brothers and sisters, and one person turns into 20 the next year and pretty quick you get wiped out. and then it'll be 2-3 years before you come back up again.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, when we go down a little bit, other farms are coming on.
Mm-hmm.
And we just ship people around best we can.
Wow, okay. So, and you find the cut your own right here in Chittenden County is enough to do what you need in terms of income and keep your farm selling your product.
Yeah, we're always struggling with balancing the amount of trees we have versus the customers that are looking for them.
Wow. And are customers looking for bigger trees these days or smaller trees? Any trend there?
It was surprising to me this year. We sold a ton of trees that were 6 feet or smaller.
Uh-huh.
But we also have one whole field that's all 10 or 12 foot type trees.
Hmm.
And we sold those, thousands of those out of there this year.
Wow. Okay.
So there's a mix. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That's interesting. I find as I get older, I tend to go with a smaller tree.
I certainly do.
Easier to handle and
there's
around.
There's a tree stand that we sell now that makes life so much better. It's called a pin stand. You drill a tapered hole in the bottom of the tree, and you walk in and drop it on the stand. It takes maybe 5 seconds to put a tree up and take
wow.
it down.
Huh.
Makes it a lot more fun.
Instead of getting down on the floor and using those little screw things, you have to tighten and loosen and
too many years.
It's always a challenge at Christmas time to get the tree up and straight, and many, many families, I'm sure, have had their struggles with that. But it's also, you know, part of the ritual, and it's a lot of fun to trim the tree and set it up and decorate it, all that fun stuff. So, Tell me a little bit about when did the trees start to sell? I mean, are they going out before Thanksgiving or is it not till after Thanksgiving?
We don't open till Black Friday.
Okay.
Some farms open a little bit earlier, but we like, at our place, we like to leave them to where when the majority of the people want to come, they're seeing the first trees out of the farm. And they haven't been handpicked and that kind of stuff. But different farms open. And some farms are only open weekends. Some, like ours, we're open 7 days a week.
And do you have a do you cut some of them to for the folks who don't want to go out in the field with a saw, or do you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I would think there's some people who might want to be able to just stop by and say, hey, there's a nice one. I'm taking that, strap it on top of the car, and let's get out of here.
There are farms in our area that they have maybe 1,000 trees to sell, and they'll sell 7,000 or 8,000 a year just from bringing them from other places. But people like to come out to a farm primarily. That's a pretty big thing for a lot of folks.
Well, how many members of the association are there, Ron? How many Christmas tree growers?
It's not 100% clear. There's nothing in this that's clear, but it's probably in Vermont, there's probably between 100 and 150 growers.
I see. Okay.
Some belong to associations, and others are in a little town somewhere, and they just got a little few out back.
Uh-huh. And is Vermont a particularly big state for this? I mean, compare it to New Hampshire or Maine or whatever.
Yeah.
Are they about equal? Or?
We're big for New Hampshire, but in the countrywide, we're very small. The big areas are Oregon, Michigan, North Carolina. Those are the primaries.
I see. Okay. And again, this is all people coming to the farm. You don't ship anywhere.
Oh, gosh, no. No. when we go down, we buy in from other farms that are friends. But
yeah, I see. Okay.
So right now, the wholesale business is very good. It's probably too good. Anybody can sell any tree they can grow on a truck.
Wow.
But the choose and cut goes along about where it's been. Patrick here runs one down in Montpelier, a little small choose and cut. We run them in Burlington. You know, we all sell probably more than we want to. And you'd like to have enough for everybody, but this year we did. But in a couple of years, we'll probably be down enough to where we won't.
So it sounds like people who want a good tree and want a good selection of trees want to get there at least a couple of weeks before Christmas. Is that right?
Yeah, we usually close down by the 20th. By then, we're pretty well burned out. And there's still an awful lot of people coming in. They can't understand why they can't go cut a tree, and we try to get them out to another farm or whatever.
That's got to be kind of heartbreaking, though, when you show up on the 23rd for a Christmas tree and think you're going to just pick one and take it home, and you go, "Aw, no more trees left. Sorry."
Well, especially when it's they've been waiting for their son to come home from college.
Yeah, right.
And he just got home, and now this is something they really want to do. And you tell them they can't, and it isn't a good time. And we usually try to sell good times, and so that's a difficult thing.
Well, it sounds like there's some challenges, but also some real rewards in this business. And so, do you recommend others get into it if they can?
I do if they own the land and they don't need income.
Uh-huh.
A lot of folks look at it as a retirement type of thing,
but it's
a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Shearing Christmas trees, everybody I know that's in the Christmas tree business, their right arm doesn't work very well anymore. They all have tennis elbow, their ligaments all get strained from shearing Christmas trees.
Wow. Huh.
There's some barriers, but in by and large, it works pretty good for most folks.
Got it. Okay. Well, Bob White, thank you very much for stopping by this morning. You're joined by Patrick White here from Montpelier. I'm sorry we don't have a little more time to get Patrick on, but we got to move on. Both with the Vermont Christmas Tree Growers Association, and I wish you luck in the coming years. Continued success in your chosen line of work. So thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Alrighty. I want to bring in my next guest. His name is Michael Palmer, and he comes from St. Albans, and he's a beekeeper there. And Michael, thanks so much for joining the program this morning.
Well, thank you, and good morning, Vermont. What a beautiful winter we're having.
Yeah, it certainly is. So beekeeping is a fascinating field to me. It's something I don't know much about, but I certainly have a lot of respect for the tolerance of beekeepers to put up bee stings.
Yeah, it's nothing. You know, well, I guess that's, you have to take that with a grain of salt. There are spots on the old body that are a little more sensitive than others.
I would imagine so.
Like the end of your nose.
Yep. Oh, yikes.
Projections.
Yeah. That must make a nice target for the bees, too.
Oh, yeah, especially when you got furry hair below it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All sorts of fun for bees, I'm sure. But and you were telling me on the break a minute ago, you pretty much get bee stings every day, right?
Oh, of course, every day.
Yeah, wow. So tell me about the life of a beekeeper. What is and I'm sure it changes from season to season, but is this a full-time job for you?
Yeah, of course. I get over 1,000 hives of bees, and so it's a full-time job for 4 months of the year.
For 4 months of the year.
Yeah, I mean, excuse me. For 8 months of the year.
8 months of the year. And then the other 4 months you...
We work in the shop, repairing equipment, building equipment.
I see.
Maybe take a little break and go on a vacation. So
yep.
In November, I was in Mexico for 2 weeks on a speaking tour.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they called it the Palmer Tour 2019. And so we went to Xochimilco near Mexico City, and then 3 presentations in the state of Oaxaca.
Nice. Wow.
Awesome. Huh. Awesome, awesome trip.
How's your Spanish?
Yo conozco poquito.
Okay.
See?
Uh-huh.
It's getting better.
Okay.
You know, I was even praised for my Spanish getting better.
That's great.
Than the last time I was there.
That's well, it's better than getting worse, right?
There you go.
So, my Spanish, I took a little bit in school, but these days I'm not real fluent, shall we say.
Studied it in 8th and 9th grade also.
Yeah. Well, so what got you into beekeeping? What?
Actually, the Extension Service back in around 71 or, no, probably 73 or 4, they offered a 9-week short course on beekeeping. And it was taught by Enoch Tompkins, which was the Extension beekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
He's passed away now, and they've done away with the program. But he's my first teacher. Back was in 73 or 4.
Wow. And so... Once you got through that 9-week course, you decided to buy yourself some hives and get started?
Yep, and I still knew nothing about bees. and both my colonies died that winter.
Oh,
of course.
You got to have your bumps in the road, especially starting out.
Well, there's more than just putting bees in your backyard and harvesting honey.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like you don't put a faucet on a maple tree and get maple syrup, so it's the same.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
And What kind of investment? If somebody wanted to start out, say, I'm going to be a beekeeper, have some capital, right?
Yes. Right now, starting with bees is very expensive.
Hmm.
When I started, a package of 3 pounds of bees and a queen in a screen box was $10.50. Now I'm seeing them listed for over $200.
Wow.
You know, you're talking about $300 or $400 to set yourself up with clothing and tools and one beehive. Which is very much. I used to be able in the 70s, and I could buy bees, 2-story boxes, strong colonies, take your pick, for $70.
Hmm. Wow.
And when I retire, I won't sell my bees for less than $300.
Less than $300
a colony.
A colony, okay. And you have how many colonies now?
Over 1,000.
Wow. So how many acres of land is devoted to beekeeping then?
Well, let's see. I have 40 apiaries.
Mm-hmm.
I got 20 in Vermont and 20 in New York State, all in the Champlain Valley.
Hmm.
And so if you figure out all the area from, say, Highgate Springs at the Canada border down to 104 by the Georgia Low Bridge, where you can see the three towers,
mm-hmm.
and I have an apiary every 2 miles, all that whole area. So how many acres is in half of Franklin County and
well,
half of Clinton County? A lot of acres.
I didn't realize you were spread out that much. Is there a reason for that? You don't want to have them all in one place?
Exactly, because if you have too many cattle in one pasture, none of them do well. So if you have too many colonies of bees in one place, they all suffer.
Hmm.
There isn't enough forage.
Mm-hmm.
And especially now that the Champlain Valley is turning into a corn and soybean field. No more clover, no more alfalfa. It's all corn. Bees don't work corn.
Hmm.
So there's nothing there. It's a desert.
Huh. And have you talked to growers of other crops and said, hey, how about some more alfalfa? Or?
Yeah, they don't. Corn is king now.
Yeah.
And so they're turning everything into cornfields.
Is that, now talk to me, there's been a lot of reporting over the last decade or so about colony collapse and so on. Is that still an issue, or are we turning that around, or where are we on that?
Colonies are still collapsing, but it's no novel pathogen. It's more like it comes from varroa mite, which is an invasive parasite that came out of Asia. And because the varroa mite damages the immune system of the honeybee, viruses that are present always in a beehive overtake the bees and kill the colony.
I see.
And that's what colony collapse was. Finally, after years and years of research and millions of dollars spent on what is this problem, they finally decided it's varroa mite.
Wow. And so the have you personally been affected a lot?
Of course. We've been dealing with this for 30 years. Hmm. 2 years ago, I lost 40% of my apiaries.
Wow.
Because of varroa mites.
So when you say that they're spread out up and down the Champlain Valley, do you rent sections of field from other farmers?
From farmers, of course. Yeah. I try to find, you know, oftentimes there was an old house that's long gone, but there's a dry road in and some brush for windbreaks, and I like those kind of spots because you can get in and... But now, with everybody wanting to buy housing, those spots are the ones that are being sold by the farm, and so I lose my apiary.
Yeah, that's...
Another problem right now is it's not just agriculture and weather and parasites and pathogens. It's the fact that so much cheap, adulterated honey is coming into this country. I can buy all the honey I want at the port of entry in the U.S. for 50 cents a pound.
Wow.
Coming from every country in the world. How can we do this? How can we survive on? I used to get $2.50 a pound for my honey bulk, and I can't get $1.50 now.
Wow, that's tough.
And so it's killing us.
Huh. Well, I'm not. We'll have to get into solutions of maybe. Bill Mayers is also with the Beekeepers Association. Going to be joining me after the break that we're getting up. Going to for the top of the hour here.
All I'm asking is that the state of Vermont put people out in the field to check labels.
Okay.
And do something about the illegal and the misleading labeling that's going on in the honey on the shelves at all your grocery stores. Go check it out.
Okay. Michael Palmer, got to go to a break here, but I really appreciate you sitting down with us for a few minutes to talk about the beekeeping industry. We'll continue on that with Bill Mayers when we get back after the break.
Sure. Have a good day, guys.
Thanks. We'll be back shortly.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, broadcasting live from the Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction. And because this is the week of the Vermont Farm Show, a three-day event here, a real extravaganza, lots of exhibits, lots of talks and meetings of various associations of growers. We've got the beekeepers in town. We've got the Christmas tree growers in town. We've got virtually every other kind of agriculture that happens in Vermont represented here at the Farm Show. I wanted to continue on the beekeeping theme for a few minutes. We had Michael Palmer on just before the top of the hour there, and I've got another beekeeper on with us right now. Bill Mayers is from Burlington and has a small apiary there and is the author of a book about beekeeping. We'll learn some about that in the next few minutes. Bill Mayers, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks, Dave. It's great to see you again.
And tell me about the book, The Land of Milk and Honey.
Well, about 5 years ago... we got challenged at a summer meeting to write a history of beekeeping in Vermont. And Ross Conrad, a professional beekeeper, and I took up the challenge. And with the help of four other people over the last 5 years, not working full-time, but part-time most of the time, we finished this what we think is really a marvelous book and the first real history of estate beekeeping in the United States. So we're really hoping it'll be a model for other states to do the same thing.
And is Vermont a particular standout among states when it comes to beekeeping?
No, in all honesty, it has some people of national and world repute, like Charlie Mraz and the Mraz family, which is now in its third generation of ownership of Champlain Valley Apiaries in Middlebury. But Mike Palmer is well known, Ross Conrad is well known, Kirk Webster is well known. We're little, but we're loud. But we're not a dominating factor, both in terms of our production. But we think that we've had a laudable and a compelling history with lots of interesting people along the way. So it makes for a good history.
When did beekeeping kind of first come to the fore in Vermont? Has it been here since the first even before European settlers, or?
Oh yeah, the beekeeping industry in the United States really took off in the 1850s when the construction of the Langstroth hive allowed beekeepers to industrialize, and Vermont was very soon thereafter, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There grew up a number of beekeepers in the state, and it was a noticeable. Had an influence on national beekeeping, and my favorite beekeeper in those first years was a guy named Augustine Manham from Bristol, who was a Civil War veteran. He fought in the final day of Gettysburg and survived. Both guys on either side of him were killed, and he came home and started beekeeping, and he eventually became the largest beekeeper in the state in the 1890s.
Wow. And the how many beekeepers are there in Vermont, people who actually make part of their living or their full living off of it?
Well, I think most of them are hobbyists or sideline, we'd say backyard beekeepers with less than 10 hives. The people who have between, say, 100 and 1,000 bees, like hives like Mike, they have half the 12,000 hives in the state, and the rest of us with less than 100 hives have approximately, the other half. So most people have 1 to 5 hives.
Now, you live in Burlington, correct?
I do.
And
yep.
Are your hives right at your home? Or?
I have 2 hives at my home. I have 6 hives at the Intervale, and I have 6 hives up at UVM.
Okay. So, I usually think of beekeeping as kind of a rural activity, but it sounds like you're doing it in an urban
setting.
Oh,
no. There's been a great rush of people around the country to do urban beekeeping, and the major beekeeping magazines have monthly columns about one woman has titles her column "Listen to Your Bees," and she just specializes in urban beekeeping. So, no, the main thing. There are certain best practices. I don't put 8 hives in my backyard, but 2 is a good number. My neighbors seem to be happy with that, and I go around and bribe them with honey every year, and that seems to keep them happy.
Okay. Bribing with honey probably works pretty well, I'm
yeah.
sure. That, and you are a beer maker from way back as well.
In fact, that's right. Yeah.
When we talked about all this yesterday, you were telling me you started both 40-some-odd years ago.
Yeah, 73. I started both hobbies when my wife and I lived in St. Johnsbury, and I wasn't nearly as good a Well, I'm not nearly a very good beekeeper, but I'm a better beekeeper than a brewer. But it was fun to do both of those two things at the same time.
Well, it does seem like, I guess you could almost say there's some cross-pollination there. No pun intended.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, two-thirds of a pun, P-U. Right.
I wonder, has one effort on your part supported the other?
No.
No.
No. No, and occasionally I have... Very occasionally, I put a little bit of honey in my beer, but I don't even make mead, which is all, it's a really honey wine. I just don't like mead because it's too sweet.
Okay, so that's kind of where I was going with that. I was thinking that's where beer and honey kind of meet, isn't it?
Well, I'm partners with the guys at House of Rheumatology, and we've put honey into beer, but the interesting thing is it's a very high class carbohydrate, and it does not the taste does not remain in the beer. You get a clearer beer, a clearer is a better word for it, and a lighter beer, but it's not, you don't do it for the taste.
Another beverage from Vermont that is making a name for itself, has some honey in it, is, of course, this Bar Hill. Their gin is made with juniper and honey. And is that something that you're seeing as a possible market for beekeepers in terms of the spirits industry?
Well, that may be above my pay grade. I know that one of the guys who founded Bar Hill was a well-known beekeeper here in the 70s and 80s, Todd Hardy. And so I think that may have been one of the ideas that he had. But I don't want to go into spirits. That's too complicated.
Too complicated. Yeah. Lots of federal regulation on that one too.
Lots more federal regulation.
Yeah, that's part of the difficulty there. In terms of beekeeping, how many pounds do you make a year, would you say?
Well, my hives produce about 50 or 60 pounds of honey that I harvest per year, and that's kind of the Vermont average.
And you say you actually do sell some of that commercially, right?
Yeah, I have two partners. We have BTV Honey, and we're all in, well, one guy's moved to Jericho, but we're right in Chittenden County, and we have probably 30 hives between us, and so we produce that honey and sell it in three or four places.
Typically local co-ops or groceries?
Well, City Market and the Intervale Food Co-op. Mm-hmm. And we've sold some to foam brewers, and they have used it. But it's primarily City Market and Intervale Food Hub.
Now your book here, this Land of Milk and Honey, you said you worked on it for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And how far back into Vermont beekeeping history does it go?
Well, it goes back to the early 1800s when there was a spate of people around the world who were trying to solve to split the atom of beekeeping, we like to say, of trying to figure out how to extract honey without killing the bees. And no one was really able to do it. They built all sorts of contraptions and patented them, including six or eight Vermonters who got U.S. patents. And one of them got a patent signed by Andrew Jackson in 1836. But then in 1851, Langstroth invented the removable frame hive, and that changed beekeeping around the world in the next 10 years. But Vermont was really in on the search for how best to get honey out of your hives without killing the bees.
And it's been onward and upward ever since.
Well, it's had its ups and downs, gradually. But it's interesting that the technology of beekeeping has not changed very much since the 1860s. I mean, the tools we have, the smoker, the hive tool, the extractor, are all about the same as they had as they were in those early years.
And these are the tools, obviously, that you use every day. And
yeah, the hive tool is my sixth finger.
All right. Well, Bill Mayers, I really appreciate you filling us in some more about beekeeping in Vermont. It sounds like really kind of a fascinating, and I don't know, I admire the folks who are willing to get out there.
It's the greatest hobby you could have. You use all of your senses, and it's a mixture of science and love, and everyone should do it.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Thanks again for joining me.
No, it was my pleasure.
My next guest is Wendy Wilton. She is worn a variety of hats around Vermont. She's a former state senator from Rutland County, was a longtime treasurer in the city of Rutland. And last few years, she's been working as the state director for the farm. And so tell me a little bit about farm services.
Participate with Vermont Agricultural Credit Corporation a lot, as well as Yankee Farm Credit and other lenders around the state, so that we guarantee some of the loans that they make, similar to an SBA guarantee, or we participate with them. Maybe they're making a loan, they got a first position in a farm ownership, and we have a second, or we've made a direct loan on equipment, and they've got the mortgage on the farm, that kind of thing. So FSA plays a really important role. We're not in the position of taking anything away from the private sector, or in the case of VAC, the public state funding, but to participate and support farmers in their beginning phase and in their mid phase. We have caps on how much we can lend, so we're not in there for, you know, the huge, huge farms. As an example of that, on a guaranteed loan, we can lend up to $1.7 million, and on a direct loan for farm ownership, $600,000, and for operating, $400,000. So we can't lend beyond that, but our place is to support the industry and to support the other lenders and certainly the producers. Now, what makes us unique on the lending side is that as a government agency, we can be very participatory in terms of working directly with the producer on their success and analyzing their operation with them over time. We're required to maintain that relationship, that close relationship, which is also supportive. The other side of the house is programs, and we can talk about that in a minute, but you might have a question about the loan side.
On the loan side, I just wonder, are we in a good period for farmers, or what's your default rate like? Is it going up? Is it going down?
You know, what's interesting? It's been fascinating to me because, you know, my background was actually banking before I became city treasurer, but the default rate is very low in Vermont. It's amazing. I mean, we have a portfolio of $180 million just in Vermont between guaranteed and direct loans, and our default rates are 2% or lower. I mean, that's just amazing, and it speaks to two things. The people of Vermont who are farmers and how dedicated they are to making things work, and it also speaks to the folks in my staff that they're not putting people in bad positions in terms of financing, and I think that goes a long way in terms of supporting your customer and making sure you're doing the right thing. There's nothing worse than an entity that might lend money to a very risky operation, knowing full well that they could fail. You know, that doesn't help anybody. So, you know, it's important to recognize that.
One of the areas of emphasis, I'm understanding, for the FSA is in helping out beginning farmers with financing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, this is really, really a great area of growth, I believe. This is also an emphasis by Secretary Perdue, the current USDA secretary. And we've always had programs for beginning farmers and ranchers, but we've got a new emphasis on this throughout the organization, particularly with outreach. Now, the farmer demographic nationwide, Dave, is pretty old. And the secretary recognizes that, and we've really got to reach out to those people that are getting into the industry. And there are a lot of people that, you know, in Vermont, you know, you look around, there's a lot of people dipping their toe in the water on agriculture. You know, they're raising a few beef cattle, or they started raising chickens, and maybe they started selling eggs at the farmer's market. It's those folks that some of them may retain a backyard or kind of, you know, participation in the industry. But some of them are actually maybe poised to grow. And those are the people that we're ready to help. And for example, beginning farmer loans, we've got a little bit more leniency on some of the criteria. We can waive the fees for a guaranteed loan. And we definitely have an emphasis on that. And what constitutes a beginning farmer is somebody who's been in farming less than 10 years.
Right. And so one of the areas that I understand quite a number of younger people with an interest in agriculture are heading to Vermont is into hemp. Hemp, of course, was just legalized by the federal government, I think, last year. Uh-huh. Are you making loans on hemp these days?
We can't until this spring. Well, now. We can now consider it. Last year we couldn't because the rules weren't promulgated yet. We can, but, you know, the risk there is that some farmers grew a crop, but at the end of the day they didn't have a purchaser for the crop. You know, it's going to go through its fits and starts as a growing industry, and so it has some inherent risk as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to recognize that. But where someone is well-positioned and has a market, that's where we'll be looking to develop our criteria if we're going to lend on it. We didn't last year, but we are poised to do so this year in 2020.
And in terms of other crops that are generally thought of less often in Vermont, certainly than like dairy, talk to me a little, anything from saffron to small greens to indoor farming, the whole full range?
Yeah, we can lend on any of that. As long as somebody is an agricultural producer, which means they are producing a product for food or fiber, mm-hmm. and they're selling it. You know, I mean, it's not just for your own use.
Right.
So we have a variety of programs, but lending is lending, and it's really just all about making sure that the business plan is sound and that you have control of the land that you're utilizing for that production. We fund vegetable growers, fruit growers, apple operations, beef. We do a lot of dairy, of course, as you can imagine, and beekeepers. I mean, mm-hmm. the gamut. Where we've seen a lot of growth, actually, though, in the agricultural industry in Vermont is in maple.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of growth in maple. People that started out as sort of a hobby now, you know, with, you know, 4,000 taps and that kind of thing. So we've seen a lot of growth there. Hmm. That and a little bit in honey, too. Although it's hard, I think, to be a bigger producer in honey, a lot of small ones. But we've seen a little bit of that.
Some of the locally produced honeys are just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It's really healthy for you.
Yeah. Hey, I did want to shift over to the programmatic aspects of FSA a little bit, too, just with a few minutes to go here. Talk to me a little bit about those.
Okay. So we've covered the farm loan side, mm-hmm. and anybody who's interested in a farm loan, they can contact any of our 9 offices around the state, and you can find it at usda.gov, and just in a search bar, put Vermont Farm Service Agency, and it'll bring you right to us.
Okay.
But on the program side, that is really about money that we're giving out. We're not lending it and expecting repayment, obviously, but we have disaster relief, such as environmental conservation program. Where this has really been utilized a lot in the last couple of years is we've had some serious windstorms in Vermont, mm-hmm. and have affected the maple producers. And so you can imagine in a sugar bush, you got trees down all over, take the tubing down. So we're able to go out there and assess the damage and help support that producer to get back online. Hmm. We also do price support, and this is really important. In 2018 for dairy, between the tariff program and the dairy support program, we put out $10 million to dairy farmers. And in 2019, we put out $11.5 million. So that was important support, price support for Vermont dairy.
And these, again, are more along the lines of grants than loans.
Well, you enroll in a program, mm-hmm. and the program pays out under certain criteria.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Price supports work like that. I mean,
right.
It depends on.
For dairy, it was all about the margin.
Yep.
If the margin was thin, it paid out over a certain amount, you know.
Right, right. And the once again, the FSA is something that can be reached. The best way is to contact you online.
I think so, because that way you'll get the phone number of your regional office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have 9 offices throughout the state, so we're out there.
Wow. And you get around to all of them, I gather? You travel?
Oh, I do, yeah. Love it. It's great. And by the way, we're farmer-driven. Each one of those 9 offices has a county committee made up of producers that are elected by their peers to serve on that committee. And we also have a state committee to guide us on the statewide operation that is also made up of producers.
Well, it sounds like a fun gig you've landed here.
I love it.
Yeah. All righty. And so I wondered also if you are in a situation where you can talk to us a little bit about just the future. I mean, are you bright and hopeful about Vermont agriculture, or do you feel like the clouds are forming, or what's
happening? Well, you know, I am, and I think it's about diversified agriculture and about people wanting to know where their food is coming from. And I'm totally on board with that. But I really hope that people understand that dairy is also good food. Whether you choose organic or conventional, it is really good for you, and it's important for children, and I really wish people would consider that and make sure they know that that's local and that's Vermont.
I had whole milk on my cereal this morning. So.
You are awesome, Dave.
Wendy Wilton, the State Director of the Farm Service Agency with the USDA, thanks so much for stopping by this morning.
Oh, thanks so much.
And we will take a brief break here. It's the bottom of the hour. CBS News, and shift to a couple other topics as we come back and finish out the last half hour of the Dave Graham Show this morning. We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. and we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat. But we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction. And the reason we are here is because this is the Vermont Farm Show, the first of 3 days. WDEV is broadcasting live. It's the Dave Graham Show. It's going to be Bill Sayre's Common Sense Radio, which runs from 11 to 12. We've got some other, a couple of other maybe off-the-farm topics. One is that Digger.org, a terrific news organization here in Vermont, just made an announcement yesterday that they have received a huge influx of money and basically prestige and honor in the form of a grant from the National Journalism, the American Journalism Project, I should say, which is a new nonprofit, national nonprofit, supporting the production of local news, supporting what is still a fairly shoestring operation. They are putting their money back into the news product and hiring reporters every time they can come up with it with another. Okay, can I hear her? Is Ann Galloway there?
Hi there.
Okay, I think I just heard Ann's voice. My word, technology works occasionally. Ann, good morning.
Good morning.
And tell us a little bit about the American Journalism Project and what has just happened here.
Yes, the American Journalism Project is a national program. The initiative is geared toward developing nonprofit models for journalism across the country, and we're one of 11 groups across the country that has been selected not only for grant monies that will be distributed over a three-year period, but also some intensive training and partnering with AJP to further solidify our underwriting, e-commerce, and membership program so that VT Digger can be sustainable over the long haul. So all the money will be used to be invested in the business office, and so that will enable us to continue to maintain and develop our news programming.
So this is money that, as you say, will go mainly or solely to the business office of VT Digger?
That's right, yes.
Okay, and obviously the business office is a key engine of the operation, because they are the folks who do the fundraising and do the work on the underwriting, getting sponsors to buy what underwriting, of course, is the nonprofit term for advertising, basically. Am I on the right track there?
Yes, that's right. We have a very small business staff, and the idea is to expand it a little bit to make sure that we have the sustainable funding in place over time. And the American Journalism Project grant enables us to hire those people. You know, it's very hard to raise money for business operations, and yet, you know, it's a chicken or egg thing. You have to have the business office capacity to raise the money to hire the journalists. So this enables us to make that leap and develop more business capacity so that we can stick around for the long haul.
You know, that's really interesting, because I would imagine that somebody who's making a donation to VT Digger, just one of your readers and folks around Vermont who are interested in supporting this enterprise, and obviously I recommend it every opportunity. And by the way, full disclosure, I still work part-time at VT Digger, so people can listen to this from me and take that for what it's worth. But I just also think, even if I weren't working there part-time, I would think that this is an amazingly valuable part of the Vermont scenery these days. We need good journalism in Vermont and in other states around the country. Vermont's very lucky to have a VT Digger as part of its journalistic landscape these days, because other parts of the journalistic landscape have withered a bit over recent years, and we gotta have good solid local coverage of things like the State House and just other goings on around the state, and so can't emphasize that enough. But I would imagine that most of the donors who agree with that, what I just said, and are sending checks occasionally to VT Digger or making online contributions over their credit cards or whatever, are probably thinking first about the news report and maybe the excellent stream of commentaries that VT Digger runs, and don't think much about, gee, I want to write a check to help pay for your fundraisers, you know, the people in the business office. And so the people who are out there selling the underwriting and so on. And so I can imagine that would be a real challenge for somebody in your shoes, Ann, who's kind of overseeing the whole organization.
Yes, you know, it has been a challenge over time. You know, we have invested, you know, 75 to 80%, sometimes more, in the newsroom operation and the technology for our platform. As opposed to, you know, the business office, and you have to have people who are, you know, skilled at financial management and, you know how to raise money through membership and underwriting and e-commerce in order to make the whole organization sing. And, you know, that's been the problem with journalism across the country, and that's why a lot of local newspapers are struggling so much, is because, and I know I've said this endlessly on your show, Dave, but, you know, we've seen a big switch in the business model nationally, and commercial news is no longer viable via the print vehicle like it used to be. Everyone is migrating online, and as a result, you know, you see a real switch in the way people are marketing their products, and they're no longer advertising like they used to with print newspapers. And on the web, you know, Google and Facebook really dominate. So what we're trying to do is to develop a model here at Digger that the American Journalism Project can use as an example for other news organizations around the country. And that's why, you know, we were one of the 11 organizations that were selected around the country, because we've made some progress in this direction already. And they see an opportunity to help us further develop that so that we really are sustainable over the long haul and are adequately covering every corner of the state. And, you know, we're still working on that every day. And we've got a ways to go. And I think in 3 years, you know, we'll be in a much better place as a result of working with the American Journalism Project and as a result of having the ability to hire a few more people who are experts in things like audience development. I know that sounds like a foreign term probably to listeners, but essentially, you know, on the web, people are competing for the attention of consumers, and we want to make sure that local news is something people are paying attention to, and so developing methods for ensuring that we're getting our stories out there in front of people is really important. So those are the kinds of things we're going to be investing in over the next 3 years.
So once you shore up the background business staff and business operations of the organization, and you begin to take advantage of what they are able to reap and add to Digger's newsroom operation, what are your first? Do you have any ideas yet for sort of first goals of things you haven't been doing yet that you'd like to add?
Well, yes. I think that we need to be able to offer more video, more podcasts. We would like to be able to hire more interns, because we're constantly working on developing a pipeline of journalists. And we're also really interested in, you know, expanding as needed in regions. But only, you know, when there are kind of holes in the landscape. So, you know, as you know, we have a reporter in the Northeast Kingdom now, and we have one reporter in southern Vermont and one in Burlington. And there's really a lot going on in local communities, and we aren't always able to provide the level of community coverage that people would like us to. Every time we do a survey, people ask us to get involved more in community reporting. And we like to do that in tandem with other news organizations. So, you know, we work with the Valley News and with other news organizations around the state. But that's definitely a need that's emerging.
Are there any other particular beats that you'd like to add to the, I mean, I know you currently, for instance, have a very strong business beat with Ann Wallace Allen, and you have Elizabeth Gribkoff doing a terrific job on the environmental beat and so on and so forth. That thought about, I don't know, adding a full-time agriculture writer, or just because I'm at the farm show, or any other topic areas like that?
Well, I do think actually that agriculture is an area that we would like to expand into, because it is an area of the state's economy that's kind of fundamental to its culture and history, and people are reinventing agriculture in the state, and people really care about mm-hmm. where their food comes from here. So yeah, actually agriculture is an area we would like to explore more. We'd also like to do more energy reporting, you know, as Vermont moves toward these really ambitious goals for energy efficiency and renewables by 2050. We see that as a real emerging need for coverage. And then, of course, you know, there's kind of an endless amount of material to cover around business, for example. And, you know, Ann Wallace Allen is doing a terrific job of going around the state and talking to companies about what they're doing. And, you know, it's there are areas of that coverage that we haven't really been able to get fully involved in, because we probably need two business reporters ultimately, because there are issues around workers' comp and OSHA and so on that we just haven't been able to get to yet. Yeah, there's kind of a limitless. There's no shortage of news. There's only a shortage of resources.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, yeah.
You know,
I think you could
before.
Add 50 more reporters and still feel like you weren't getting everything.
Well, probably. I mean, there's a limit, though. I mean, we're not going to grow endlessly. I think that, you know, we now have about 25 people on staff, and you know, I don't imagine that, you know, I think we'll plateau at around probably 32 people on staff. But I do think that there is a lot more that we could do to help people understand their communities and to understand big issues that are affecting the state.
All right. Well, onward and upward for VG Digger. Congratulations on this, on being selected. This is really looks like quite a prestigious thing and a big shot in the arm for your operation. Ann Galloway, founding editor of VG Digger, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Alrighty, we'll talk soon. But wanted to finish up today's two-hour Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM by checking in on a little bit of national news, and obviously one of the biggest stories going the last several weeks, and this week in particular, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. The Senate has been hearing arguments from lawyers so far, and big debate, of course, is whether there's going to be an introduction of evidence, witnesses, documents, etc. And we have with us, joining us on the line this morning from Axios, an excellent source of online news, axios.com. Caitlin Owens is joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Witnesses might be called in to testify.
At the end of that, but basically the scenario on the Hill is that this was looking pretty cut and dry in the White House's favor in terms of wrapping this up pretty quickly, until this weekend when remarks from former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book leaked, seeming to confirm the central part of the Democrats' allegations against President Trump. So now the outcome of whether or not we're going to see more witnesses introduced to this trial is up in the air.
The big question seems to be, we're sort of counting heads, I think, in the Senate. There are at least four Republicans who seem to be probably getting chased up and down the hall, maybe by you, as well as a bunch of other reporters who are trying to find out, read some tea leaves, or get any comment, breadcrumbs maybe, about what these senators might do. Anything sort of breaking last night or this morning in terms of what we're hearing from people like Susan Collins of Maine, or Mitt Romney's pretty much out there, but anybody else?
Right. And the reason you keep hearing the number four senators, that's the number that would have to vote with Democrats in order to have a majority of senators voting for to bring in more witnesses, such as John Bolton. So Mitt Romney has been pretty indicated he wants to hear from Bolton. Collins appears to be leaning that way, but then, you know, we're also looking at what Senators Lisa Murkowski and Lamar Alexander are going to be saying and where their heads are at.
What about the overall sort of flow of the trial here? You know, I've covered criminal trials as a reporter myself during my career, and you hear the prosecution put on its evidence, you hear the defense put on its evidence, and sometimes you can sort of get a sense of, boy, you know, the defense just scored a big touchdown or whatever, or the prosecution did. Leaving aside the raw political power here that the Senate has a Republican majority, have Trump's legal team really scored any? Have they really scored much in terms of their ability to sort of push back against the presentation made by Adam Schiff and the other House managers?
Well, you know, first of all, I think that again, this Bolton revelation of the weekend has really shaken up the entire situation. They did not address it very much yesterday. They briefly addressed it in the morning. Not the morning, but towards the beginning of their presentation. But, you know, I think that what we all need to keep in mind here is that this isn't like a normal trial. They're not talking to a jury that's supposedly non-biased. These senators are coming into this with their mind, if not made up, pretty close to made up about which way they want to vote in terms of convicting or acquitting the president. So in terms of gotcha moments, it's hard to measure it when senators are largely listening to what they want to hear.
The other question I have here is about timing. When might we know or actually have an answer to the question about whether John Bolton or anybody else will be called as a witness?
You know, I think that'll be towards the end of the week, but everything seems pretty up in the air right now. Again, things are kind of, we're waiting to see how things are going to settle after the Bolton revelation. So it could be an interesting week.
Well, I guess it's a sort of a wait-and-see posture right now then as this thing continues to unfold. Caitlin Owens of Axios, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate you doing so.
Thank you very much.
We are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We're going to be broadcasting, as I mentioned, from the Vermont Farm Show over the next couple days. We'll be here tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week, and we've got a wide variety of guests getting ready to join us. So we're going to get some help from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont. They are hosting some of the events here at the Farm Show. We're going to be hearing a little bit about, I think tomorrow is going to be a discussion about how farmers are responding to issues connected with climate change. There are obviously impacts on farmers. There are questions about farm operations and their resiliency. Can they respond to a changing climate? What do they need to do? Are there any areas of emphasis that they need to change? Are there any practices that they need to change? Are there areas where they need to worry about any of the uses of fuel or releases of methane from manure pits or any other things that are going on in the agricultural sector that have a particularly heavy impact on releases of carbon, methane into the atmosphere? These are getting to be key and crucial issues on the farm, not just in Vermont but elsewhere. Of course, we are here in Vermont, and so we'll focus on what's happening in the state. As I mentioned, we're going to be having some discussion about that tomorrow. And we are also going to be hearing on Thursday, I believe, from Diane Bothfeld, who is the sort of top dairy official. I don't remember the exact title. We'll find that out when the time draws near. But she's with the State Agency of Agriculture and Food and Markets, and she'll be visiting with us on Thursday, I believe. And so we have a lot of good stuff upcoming on the farm show. We are really happy to be able to bring this to you via WDEV's airwaves here, the Dave Graham Show. And we are, as I mentioned, and then, of course, on Friday, we will be back to the State House covering various developments in the legislature. So it's a lot of time on the road this week. Stay with WDEV for more coverage from the Vermont Farm Show, and we will be back with the Dave Graham Show once again tomorrow morning from the Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction. Have a great day, everybody.